Have you ever stopped to genuinely wonder what happens to the staggering billions of pounds of inedible animal byproducts and used cooking oil generated globally each year? I mean, these aren't small quantities. They represent a monumental disposal challenge.
Yeah, it's huge.
Or, maybe more optimistically, have you ever considered how inventive industries are finding truly surprising ways to transform what we often dismiss as waste into incredibly valuable, even essential resources? It's not just recycling, it's like a whole economic ecosystem.
But it's a profound shift in thinking, really. Mm. Historically, these materials were, like you say, just a disposal problem, often a costly and environmentally taxing one.
Right.
But the modern approach, the one leading companies are embracing, is about extracting every conceivable ounce of value. It's not just innovation. It's a foundational principle of the circular economy in action, turning liabilities into assets. Mm. You know?
Precisely. And that's exactly what we're going to unpack today on The Deep Dive.
Welcome back, everyone. Our mission here is always to take your sources, dig deep into the research, and unearth the most important nuggets of knowledge. We aim to help you become truly well-informed, quickly and thoroughly, with those aha moments that stick with you. Mm-hmm. Today, we're embarking on a fascinating deep dive into a company that fundamentally embodies this waste-to-value concept. Darling Ingredients, Inc., trading on the stock market under the ticker symbol DRR.
It's a truly unique business, DR is, operating at an astonishing scale, often kind of out of sight, but absolutely essential to our modern food systems and now increasingly to our energy future.
Yeah.
We're going to peel back the layers of their unusual business model, explore the incredibly diverse industries they operate in, dissect their recent financial performance, which has certainly had its share of ups and downs, right?
Yeah.
And then peer into their future growth opportunities. What's remarkable about Darling's story is how beautifully it blends themes of fundamental sustainability, navigating complex and sometimes wildly volatile markets, and just surprising innovation at every turn.
Absolutely.
What you can expect from us today is a clear, comprehensive picture of how Darling takes what might seem like discarded, low-value waste and transforms it into essential ingredients for everything from the premium food your pets eat to high-quality livestock feed to cutting-edge human nutrition products and even critically renewable fuels that power planes and trucks.
Yeah, planes and trucks.
It's a compelling blend of stable, mature businesses sitting right alongside a very high growth, but also very volatile segment that's directly navigating the cutting edge of global decarbonization efforts.
It's almost like looking at a microcosm of the global economy's broader transition to more sustainable practices, complete with all the inherent opportunities and crucially the very real challenges that come with it. It's a masterclass in industrial symbiosis, really.
Okay, let's unpack this core idea that truly defines Darling Ingredients, the waste-to-value principle. For them, this isn't just some catchy corporate slogan, right? It is the fundamental bedrock of their entire business model.
Exactly.
This company essentially acts as a linchpin, a critical connector in the global circular economy, systematically taking what would otherwise be considered waste streams from the vast food and agriculture industries and giving them a second, highly valuable, and often surprisingly innovative life.
That's right. And it's important to understand that this isn't a new concept for them. Their origins stretch all the way back to 1882.
Imagine that.
1882. Wow.
Yeah, they started as a traditional rendering company, a business primarily focused on processing animal byproducts like fats, bones, and protein, stuff like that. But over nearly a century and a half, they've evolved dramatically from what was once a very utilitarian service into this highly diversified, sophisticated, and technologically advanced producer of sustainable ingredients.
That's incredible evolution. Their longevity itself speaks volumes about their adaptability and profound foresight. They've seen countless economic cycles and technological shifts, yet they've remained indispensable.
That deep history truly highlights their enduring, almost infrastructural importance.
Mm-hmm.
So when we talk about their core operations and the immense scale at which they operate, what exactly are these waste streams they're working with on a daily basis? Can you give us a clearer picture?
Sure. Primarily, we're talking about what they categorize as edible and inedible bionutrients. This encompasses a huge and consistent volume of animal byproducts. Things like animal fats, bones, proteins, even feathers and blood, collected from large-scale meat processors, slaughterhouses, and even smaller food service establishments like restaurants.
Okay.
And crucially, a very significant portion of their raw material also comes from used cooking oil, often referred to as UCO, from these same food service establishments, as well as industrial food producers. Just think about the sheer volume of French fries cooked globally every single day and the oil that's left over.
Yeah, I never really considered that scale.
Right. Without a company like Darling, that used oil and those byproducts become a massive environmental burden.
The scale, then, must be absolutely immense. It sounds like a logistical marvel just to collect these materials.
It genuinely is.
Mm?
Their operational footprint is staggering.
Mm.
Over 260 facilities strategically spread across 5 continents.
5 continents?
This global reach isn't just a number on a balance sheet. It gives them incredible logistical advantages, allowing them to collect materials efficiently and process them close to the source, minimizing transport costs and maximizing freshness for certain products.
Makes sense.
And here's a statistic that truly drives home their dominant position. Darling processes an estimated 15% of the entire world's animal byproducts.
Wait, 15% of the whole world's?
15%. Let that sink in for a moment. That is a profound market share and speaks volumes about their unparalleled logistical prowess, their vast collection network, and their operational efficiency in processing these materials. They are a critical, often invisible component of the global food supply chain.
15%. That is genuinely astonishing. And from all this raw material, from what many would just see as refuse, they produce a surprisingly wide range of finished products for incredibly diverse industries. This brings us neatly to their 3 primary interconnected business segments. What are they, and how do they fit together in this waste-to-value ecosystem?
So their operations are primarily divided into 3 distinct but very much interconnected segments: feed ingredients, food ingredients, and fuel ingredients.
Feed, food, and fuel. Okay.
The interconnectedness is a profound strategic advantage here because, as we'll discuss in more detail, some of the raw materials processed in one segment can become highly valuable feedstock for another segment.
Ah, interesting.
This creates a highly efficient integrated ecosystem within the company, reducing waste to virtually zero and optimizing the value extraction from every pound of raw material.
To give you a clearer, more tangible picture of their financial composition and how these segments contribute to the overall enterprise, let's look at their revenue snapshot from the second quarter of their fiscal year 2025. This really shows how these different pillars weigh into their total business.
Yeah, the numbers help clarify things.
For the feed ingredients segment, they reported $936.5 million in net sales for Q2 2025. Which made up a very significant 63.2% of their total net sales. This clearly underscores its foundational role.
Well, that rock, really.
Then the food ingredients segment brought in $386.1 million, accounting for a solid 26.1% of the total. And finally, the fuel ingredients segment, which is where things get particularly interesting, registered $158.8 million, or 10.7% of total net sales.
Now, here's a crucial clarification, and it's absolutely vital for understanding Darling's true overall financial picture and its immense exposure to the renewable fuels market.
Okay, what's the catch?
Those figures for the fuel segment, that $158.8 million and 10.7%, only represent Darling's wholly owned operations. They explicitly do not include the sales from the Diamond Green Diesel, or DGD, joint venture.
Oh, right. DGD. That's their big partnership with Valero, isn't it?
Exactly. And this is a point that can often be overlooked by those not deep in the financial statements.
That's a significant detail, right? Because DGD is such a huge part of their overall story and their strategic direction. Why isn't its revenue included directly?
It absolutely is a massive detail. DGD's financial results are accounted for using what's known as the equity method.
Equity method, okay.
This means that Darling holds a 50% ownership stake. And rather than consolidating DGD's full revenue and expenses onto Darling's income statement, Darling's 50% share of DGD's net income or net loss shows up as a single line item, usually titled equity and net income loss of Diamond Green Diesel.
Got it. So it hits the bottom line, but not the top line sales number we just quoted.
Precisely. So while DGD contributes very substantially to Darling's bottom line profitability and cash flow, its enormous revenue isn't directly factored into that 10.7% figure for the wholly owned fuel segment. This nuance is critical because DGD is a multi-billion dollar revenue generator, and its performance has a disproportionate impact on Darling's overall financial health, even if it's reported in a different manner than their wholly owned segments.
So that 10.7% really understates the fuel segment's true economic impact on Darling.
Massively. It means the fuel segment's overall impact on Darling is far, far larger than that 10.7% revenue share might initially suggest. Building on that, let's dive deeper into each of these 3 pillars, starting with the feed ingredients segment. This one genuinely acts as the stable backbone of Darling's operations. It's the less flashy but utterly reliable engine.
It sounds like the true financial anchor rather than the high-flying growth engine we might associate with some of their other ventures, like the DGD piece.
Precisely. The market for global rendering, which is where the feed segment primarily operates, is, by its very nature, a mature and stable industry. In 2023, it was valued at approximately $22.3 to $22.5 billion.
Okay, so a big market, but not explosive growth.
Right. We're talking about a market that isn't going to explode overnight. It's projected to grow at a modest compound annual growth rate of about 2.5% to 2.9% through 2032.
Pretty steady.
This inherent stability comes from its fundamental link to global meat production. As long as people eat meat, there will be animal byproducts, and importantly, its absolutely critical role in sustainability. Rendering prevents billions of pounds of animal byproducts from simply becoming waste in landfills, which would generate significant greenhouse gases like methane.
That's a huge environmental benefit.
It actively contributes to a profoundly impactful circular economy, transforming what would be a significant environmental problem into useful products.
So what exactly are they producing in this segment? When we say animal byproducts, for example, what kinds of finished products are derived from those?
Here, the focus is on a wide variety of essential fats and proteins. When we talk about animal byproducts, think beyond just the basic fats and bones. We're talking about feathers, hooves, blood, and various animal proteins.
Right, the less appealing bits.
Yeah, exactly. But these aren't just commodity products. They are meticulously processed into highly nutritious ingredients for animal nutrition. This includes everything from livestock feed for poultry, swine, and cattle, to aquaculture feed for farmed fish, and even specialized pet food ingredients. They also produce organic fertilizers.
So it covers a lot of ground in animal nutrition.
It really does. This segment truly underpins their entire collection and processing network. It's the consistent, cash-generative foundation that allows them to support other, more volatile, and often capital-intensive ventures, providing a crucial operational and financial ballast for the entire company.
That makes perfect sense. It's the reliable, foundational business that provides the consistent cash flow any large enterprise needs. Now, let's pivot to the food ingredients segment. This one feels like it's positioned for higher value, more innovation, and perhaps a more direct connection to consumer trends.
You're absolutely spot on. This segment directly taps into a powerful, almost irreversible trend we're seeing globally in both human nutrition and, somewhat surprisingly, pet food.
Premiumization. Premiumization, right. We hear that a lot.
It's particularly evident in the profound humanization of pets, where pet owners are increasingly treating their furry companions as integral family members.
Yeah, my dog eats better than I do sometimes.
Exactly. This means they are willing and often eager to spend more on high-quality, nutritious, and functional ingredients for their pets, mirroring their own growing focus on health and wellness. This isn't just a niche, it's a mainstream cultural shift.
So it's certainly not just about basic kibble anymore, then. We're talking about ingredients that actively support health benefits for pets and humans alike.
Far from it. This segment is focused on producing much higher value specialty ingredients. Think gelatin, which has a wide range of applications from pharmaceuticals to confectionery, and increasingly collagen peptides, which they market very successfully under their globally recognized Rousselot brand.
Oh, Rousselot, I've heard of that. Collagen is everywhere now.
It is. Collagen peptides, for example, aren't just a basic protein. They are premium components actively sought out for their documented benefits in joint health supplements, anti-aging beauty products, and even protein-enriched snack bars. They also produce edible fats and natural casings used in sausages and even hides for the high-end leather industry.
Wow, okay. Very diverse.
Their customer base here is premium and demanding, spanning the pharmaceutical, food, and health and wellness industries. These are sectors that are actively seeking natural, functional, and high-quality ingredients for their own sophisticated product lines.
And given these trends in premium products, what's the growth potential like for this specific segment? It sounds quite promising.
This segment is genuinely poised for significant growth, and that growth is being strategically accelerated by the major move they've announced regarding a dedicated joint venture, which they call Nextida.
Nextida, right. We'll touch on that more later, I assume.
We will. It's about unlocking and accelerating the value in these high-margin specialty products. By creating a focused entity, they believe they can capture an even larger share of the rapidly expanding global health and wellness market, which is constantly seeking new, natural, and effective ingredients.
Okay, that makes sense. That brings us to the third pillar, and this is where things get truly dynamic and, as you noted earlier, quite volatile. Fuel ingredients. This seems to be the high-octane growth engine, but with some significant policy-driven risks.
Precisely. It's a completely different beast from the stable, almost predictable, feed segment. The global biofuels market is currently valued at around $132 billion in 2024.
$132 billion.
And is projected to expand at an impressive compound annual growth rate of about 6.9% through 2034. That's undeniably high growth. However, the critical caveat, the defining characteristic, is that this growth, and more importantly, its profitability, are almost entirely dependent on government policies.
Ah, the policy angle again.
It's not just a market driven by conventional supply and demand. It's a market driven by mandates, incentives, and a constantly shifting regulatory landscape.
And the absolute key asset here, the centerpiece of their fuel ingredient story, is their Diamond Green Diesel, or DGD, joint venture.
Absolutely. Darling holds a 50% equity stake in DGD, with Valero Energy Corporation holding the other half. DGD is not just a player in this market, it's a colossal force. It's one of the world's largest producers of renewable diesel.
One of the largest, okay.
And crucially, it's also a significant producer of sustainable aviation fuel, or SAF, which is becoming increasingly vital for decarbonizing the hard-to-abate aviation sector.
SAF is definitely a hot topic.
This positions Darling right at the heart of the global energy transition and the profound push for decarbonization in the transportation sector. It's their direct, high-leverage bet on a greener future.
So how do these government policies actually play into the market for renewable fuels? You mentioned it's complex. Can you walk us through the specific mechanisms that make this segment so policy sensitive?
Sure. It's all about policy, and it can be incredibly intricate and volatile, almost like a separate commodity market in itself. In the U.S., you have the Renewable Fuel Standard, or RFS.
The RFS, right.
This is a federal program that mandates minimum volumes of renewable fuels to be blended into the nation's transportation fuel supply each year. To ensure compliance, this program generates tradable credits called Renewable Identification Numbers, or RNs.
RNs, okay. Tradable credits.
For every gallon of renewable fuel produced, a RN is generated, and refiners need to acquire these RNs to meet their blending obligations. The value of these RNs can be incredibly volatile, influenced by supply, demand, and regulatory uncertainty, directly impacting profitability for producers like DGD. A high RIN price means better margins, and a low RIN price means pressure. It's simple, but volatile.
So DGD's profit depends partly on this RIN credit market.
Significantly. Then there's California's Low Carbon Fuel Standard, or LCFS.
LCFS, another one.
This is a state-level program, but it's hugely influential due to California's size. It incentivizes fuels with lower carbon intensity, essentially, how much greenhouse gas is emitted over the fuel's life cycle. Producers of low-carbon fuels, like renewable diesel, earn LCFS credits based on the carbon intensity reduction they achieve.
Okay, so California adds its own layer.
Exactly. These credits can then be sold to producers of high-carbon fuels who need them to meet their own compliance targets. The LCFS credit market is also incredibly dynamic and can swing wildly, adding another layer of volatility to DGD's earnings.
Wow, so multiple credit markets to track.
And it's not just the U.S. Europe has its own influential policy, the Renewable Energy Directive, or RED, which sets ambitious targets for renewable energy and transport across the EU and creates significant structural demand for advanced biofuels, like renewable diesel and SAF.
So DGD's financial performance isn't just about selling gallons of fuel. It's almost equally, if not more, heavily intertwined with the trading value of these environmental credits and the ever-shifting regulatory landscape. It sounds like an investor in Darling needs to be an expert in biofuels policy just to understand the earnings.
Exactly. This segment is central to Darling's entire growth strategy and its exposure to the global push for decarbonization. But it comes with a very significant degree of policy-driven risk and reward. It highlights the dual nature of their business. One part is stable, grounded in fundamental supply and demand for food ingredients. The other is riding the waves of global environmental policy and energy transition.
Understanding that interplay is absolutely key, then.
It is. It's key to understanding Darling Ingredients as an investment or as a critical player in the global economy.
What's genuinely fascinating here is how Darling Ingredients has built in some unseen, almost hidden advantages that go far beyond just their product lines. Let's talk about their vertical integration. It sounds like a pretty strategic move, but how deep does it go?
It's more than strategic. It's a foundational, almost unassailable competitive advantage. Darling operates a profoundly integrated supply chain that begins right at the source, the collection of raw materials.
From the very start.
They have a massive, intricate network of over 100,000 suppliers. Think every restaurant, every supermarket, and crucially, every major meat processor that generates these byproducts. They manage this colossal collection effort with their own specialized fleet of vehicles, tailored for different types of material.
Their own trucks, their own network.
Right. This complete control over the entire value chain, from collecting the waste to meticulously processing it into highly specified finished products, gives them a distinct edge in consistently sourcing feedstock and rigorously managing costs. They aren't reliant on third-party collectors for their primary inputs. They are the collection network.
And this leads to what you called an internal hedging mechanism. That sounds incredibly intriguing. How exactly does that work, and how significant is it?
This is truly a clever aspect of their design, a natural counterbalance built into their diversified structure.
Mm-hmm.
A crucial part of their vertical integration is the internal supply of feedstock, specifically animal fats, and used cooking oil that flows from their stable feed ingredient segment directly to their fuel ingredient segment, and most significantly, to the Diamond Green Diesel joint venture.
Ah, so feed supplies fuel.
Exactly. For instance, in the second quarter of 2025, Darling reported $291.5 million in net sales to related party Diamond Green Diesel. This wasn't an external sale generating new revenue. It was their own feed segment supplying DGD with critical raw materials.
So they're essentially selling raw materials to themselves, or at least to their 50% owned joint venture. How does that create a hedge against market volatility?
It creates a powerful partial offset to market volatility that few, if any, of their competitors can replicate. Let's imagine a scenario where the market price for fats, which are a key feedstock for DGD, goes up significantly.
Okay, so DGD's costs go up. Bad for DGD.
On one hand, yes, that means DGD's input costs increase, which would normally eat into DGD's profitability. However, simultaneously, because Darling's feed segment is a massive producer of those very same fats, rising fat prices directly boost the revenue and margins within Darling's core, wholly owned feed business.
Ah, I see. So one part of the business benefits when the other faces higher costs.
Exactly. So what might dampen profits in one part of the consolidated entity through higher input costs simultaneously boosts revenue and margins in another part? It provides a degree of earning stability and resilience that non-integrated competitors simply don't have, acting as a natural counterbalance within their own operations. It's like having two sides of a seesaw where one goes up when the other goes down, keeping the overall system more balanced.
That's a brilliant, almost elegant way to manage risk. It truly underscores the strategic depth of their business model. Now, let's pivot to the competitive landscape. Given their unique business and multi-segment approach, do they have a single direct competitor that does exactly what Darling does across all three segments?
No, not really. You won't find a single direct competitor that spans all their segments and geographies at the same scale and integration. It's more of a fragmented and nuanced competitive landscape.
So who do they compete with in feed?
In your feed segment, which is primarily rendering, they compete with the integrated rendering divisions of major meat processors. Tyson Foods, for example, is a formidable competitor, actually estimated to hold a majority market share in the U.S. rendering and meat byproduct processing industry.
Tyson, okay. A big player.
Yeah. Other agricultural giants like Cargill and Archer Daniels Midland, or ADM, also have their own animal nutrition and processing operations that compete with parts of Darling's business.
And in the fuel segment, specifically with Diamond Green Diesel.
In renewable fuels, DGD competes with a rapidly growing number of specialized renewable fuel companies, as well as the expanding renewable energy divisions of major oil and gas corporations like Marathon Petroleum, Chevron, and Phillips 66.
The big oil companies are getting in on it, too.
Oh, yeah. Everyone's trying to get into that decarbonization space, recognizing its immense future potential. So competition here is intensifying.
What's really fascinating to me, and perhaps counterintuitive, is this concept of co-opetition that you mentioned. Can you explain that dynamic, especially with those large meat processors like Tyson or Cargill?
It's the perfect term for it, and it really highlights the unique symbiosis of this industry. With meat processors like Tyson and Cargill, Darling is both a competitor and an absolutely essential partner.
Competitor and partner, how does that work?
Well, these large meat companies generate enormous, consistent volumes of animal byproducts daily, often more than their own rendering facilities can handle efficiently or profitably. Darling steps in with its vast, efficient, and specialized collection services, becoming a critical off-taker for these byproducts.
So Darling provides a necessary service for its competitors.
Exactly. So while they might compete on the sale of some finished rendered products, they have this symbiotic, cooperative relationship that ensures a reliable supply of raw materials for Darling and provides an efficient, environmentally responsible waste management solution for the meat processors. It's a delicate balance built on mutual economic necessity, but it profoundly works.
Like frenemies, almost.
You could say that. It's almost like rival football teams sharing the same top-tier training facility because it makes economic sense for both.
That makes Darling's supply chain not just robust, but deeply ingrained in the very fabric of the industries it serves. And speaking of robust, let's talk about their competitive moats. What are the significant barriers to entry that truly protect Darling's market position, making it incredibly difficult for a new player to emerge?
This, where their scale, their historical presence, and their specialized expertise truly shine, forming what are essentially unassailable competitive moats.
Okay, lay them out for us.
First, the logistical network and geographic density are enormous moats. Rendering, at its core, is fundamentally a logistics business. Raw materials like animal byproducts are perishable and incredibly costly to transport over long distances.
Right, you need to be close.
Darling's network of over 260 facilities is not just large, it's strategically located very close to the sources of these raw materials, slaughterhouses, food processors, and restaurant hubs across five continents. A new entrant would face truly prohibitive capital costs and immense logistical challenges just to replicate that footprint. It's not just about building a factory, it's about having thousands of specialized trucks, collection points, and processing centers everywhere, all the time, ensuring efficient and timely collection before the materials degrade.
So it's not something you can just set up quickly or cheaply from scratch.
Exactly. Second, scale is their shield. Their sheer massive processing volume allows for significant economies of scale across every aspect of their operations, from raw material procurement and processing to research and development. This translates directly into a profound cost advantage that smaller regional competitors simply can't match.
Cheaper per unit because they do so much.
Right. Imagine trying to compete with a company that processes 15% of the world's animal byproducts. Their sheer efficiency means they can operate at a significantly lower cost per unit, which is a powerful competitive lever.
And given the nature of their products, I imagine regulation and compliance are huge factors.
Absolutely. The third moat is regulatory expertise and compliance infrastructure. Operating in rendering, food ingredients, and especially renewable fuels means navigating an incredibly complex and stringent web of environmental, food, and feed safety and renewable energy regulations across multiple jurisdictions globally.
That sounds like a nightmare to manage.
It can be. Darling's almost 150-year history and vast global presence have given them deep institutional knowledge and a robust compliance infrastructure. This is a huge, often unseen hurdle for any newcomer trying to enter these markets. The compliance costs, the required permits, and the specialized knowledge alone are immense, making it extremely difficult for a new player to gain traction.
What about their long-standing relationships with partners? Is that a moat too?
Definitely. That's the fourth moat. Deep, entrenched supplier and customer relationships. They've cultivated long-standing, reliable relationships with their vast network of raw material suppliers, those 100,000-plus entities, and their diversified global customer base. These relationships, built on decades of reliable service, consistent quality, and efficient logistics, create incredibly high switching costs for both sides.
Hard to break into those established connections.
Very hard. Suppliers rely on Darling to efficiently take their byproducts, often on a daily basis. And customers rely on Darling for consistent, high quality, and often highly specified ingredients that meet rigorous standards. Breaking into those established relationships is incredibly difficult.
And finally, has the industry itself contributed to this concentration of power?
Yes. The fifth moat is the ongoing industry consolidation. The rendering industry globally has seen a long-term trend of consolidation, and Darling has been a key consolidator through strategic, often large-scale, acquisitions.
They've been buying up competitors.
They have a proven track record of buying smaller regional players to expand their geographic reach, enhance their capabilities, and integrate new technologies. This ongoing trend of consolidation further raises the barriers to entry for any potential new competitors, as the dominant players just keep getting bigger, more integrated, and more entrenched, making the playing field increasingly difficult for outsiders.
So they've not only built a massive network organically, but they've also been actively shaping the industry to their advantage through strategic M&A, creating a formidable defensive position.
Precisely. It's a multi-layered defense.
Let's turn our attention to the financial story of Darling Ingredients. It's been quite a ride over the past few years, genuinely showcasing both significant growth and considerable volatility. When we look at their revenue trends, it seems like a real roller coaster of expansion and contraction.
A roller coaster is an excellent analogy, perhaps even an understatement at times. Darling saw a truly strong revenue expansion, growing from $3.39 billion in 2016 all the way up to a peak of $6.79 billion in their fiscal year 2023.
Doubled in about 7 years. That's impressive.
It is. This rapid growth was really driven by two main factors: the significant build-out and expansion of their Diamond Green Diesel facilities, which came online and scaled up, and a series of strategic, often large-scale acquisitions that broadened their capabilities and geographic reach. They had impressive year-over-year revenue growth of 32.7% in 2021, and an even more astounding 37.8% in 2022, fueled by strong commodity prices and the booming renewable fuels market.
Those are enormous growth numbers for a company of this scale, but then it seems to have hit a significant snag, almost a whiplash effect.
Exactly. The trend reversed sharply. In fiscal 2024, their annual revenue declined by a notable 15.8% to $5.72 billion.
Ouch. A 16% drop.
This contraction was almost entirely due to the deterioration in the renewable fuels market, which we discussed earlier. It was a stark reminder of the volatility inherent in that segment.
So their profitability metrics must have mirrored that decline, especially their combined adjusted EBITDA, which is a key operating measure for them.
It did, almost precisely. Combined adjusted EBITDA surged to an impressive $1.61 billion in fiscal 2023, reflecting those strong growth years and favorable market conditions. But then it fell significantly to $1.08 billion in fiscal 2024.
A big drop in profitability, too.
This vividly demonstrates the significant operating leverage in their business, especially within that fuel segment, where profitability is highly sensitive to commodity spreads and the fluctuating value of environmental credits like RINs and LCFS credits. When those external factors turn unfavorable, the impact on the bottom line is amplified.
This brings us to the central narrative of their recent financial performance, the significant DGD downturn from late 2022 through mid-2025. It sounds like that really hit them hard and impacted investor sentiment.
It was a substantial blow, and it definitely caught the market off guard. After a period of truly exceptional earnings from DGD, its profitability plummeted, particularly evident in the second quarter of 2025. Darling's 50% share of DGD's adjusted EBITDA fell by a staggering 44% year over year to just $42.6 million.
Down 44% year over year for their share of DGD's profit.
Yeah. To put that into perspective, it indicates how disproportionately DGD's performance impacts Darling's overall profitability, despite being accounted for via the equity method.
44% is a massive drop for such a critical asset. What specifically drove that, beyond just general market sentiment? You mentioned something earlier called the crush spread. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes. The crush spread is the single most critical metric for renewable diesel producers like DGD. It represents the gross margin between the selling price of renewable diesel, including the value of associated environmental credits like RINs and LCFS credits, and the cost of the feedstock, primarily animal fats and used cooking oil, required to produce it.
So selling price minus input cost, essentially.
Basically, yeah. That crush spread fell to just 56 cents per gallon in Q2 2025. For context, historical healthy margins have been much higher. It averaged an even more challenging 22 cents per gallon for the first 6 months of the year.
Just 22 cents per gallon margin on average? That sounds razor thin.
It is. This severely narrowed margin directly translated into dramatically lower profits for DGD. Imagine a coffee shop where the price of coffee beans suddenly spikes. But you can't raise your coffee prices because the market for coffee is soft and your customers are unwilling to pay more. That's essentially what happened to DGD.
And this margin collapse was largely attributed to policy, right? The very policies that are supposed to support the growth of renewable fuels. How did that happen?
Almost entirely. Management explicitly attributed this margin collapse primarily to U.S. renewable fuel policy, specifically to the regulatory uncertainty stemming from the potential for small refinery exemptions, or SREs, under the renewable fuel standard.
SREs, small refinery exemptions.
Right. When the Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA, grants these exemptions, it essentially reduces the total mandated volume of renewable fuels that refiners need to blend. This, in turn, reduces the demand for compliance credits, or RINs.
Less demand for RINs means lower RIN prices.
Exactly. This uncertainty, this fear of reduced demand for RINs, created an overhang in the RIN market, leading to depressed and delayed RIN pricing that simply didn't react quickly enough to support stronger renewable diesel margins. It's a complex interplay where regulatory actions or even the potential for regulatory actions can have immediate and profound effects on market prices for these compliance credits, directly hitting the profitability of producers.
So policy uncertainty directly crushed their margins.
Pretty much.
And the consolidated impact on Darling's overall financials must have been severe, trickling down from DGD's performance.
It was indeed. For the second quarter of 2025, Darling's consolidated net income was only $12.7 million, or a mere 0.08 cents per diluted share.
8 cents a share, that's tiny compared to their revenue.
It is. That's an alarming 84% decline from the prior year. This sharp drop forced them to make a substantial downward revision to their full-year 2025 guidance for combined adjusted EBITDA, cutting it by over $200 million from an initial range of $1.25, $1.30 billion down to $1.05, $1.10 billion.
A big guidance cut that never looks good.
No, it signals to the market that these headwinds in renewable fuels were more persistent and more impactful than initially thought, leading to some investor concern and a reevaluation of the segment's near-term outlook.
So the fuel segment really dragged down the whole company's profitability, but you also mentioned resilience in their core segments earlier. Did those provide some ballast during this severe downturn, acting as a crucial shock absorber?
Absolutely. This is precisely where Darling's diversified model truly shines and demonstrates its inherent strength. The feed segment, for instance, showed remarkable, almost counter-cyclical strength. In Q2 2025, its segment adjusted EBITDA actually increased by 11.3% year-over-year to $135.9 million.
Up 11%, while DGD was tanking.
Exactly. This was primarily driven by favorable fat pricing and consistent raw material volumes, demonstrating that the underlying demand for these products remained stable. It clearly acted as a significant stabilizing force, providing crucial cash flow when the fuel segment was under immense pressure.
And the food segment, how did that fare?
The food segment also delivered stable, reliable results. Its segment adjusted EBITDA for Q2 2025 was $69.9 million, a slight decrease from the previous year, but importantly, raw material volumes actually increased year over year.
So volumes were up even if EBITDA dipped slightly.
Right. This indicates healthy underlying global demand for their higher value products like collagen and gelatin, despite any minor market fluctuations. So even with a slight EBITDA dip, the underlying business remained robust and healthy.
That's a key takeaway then. The core traditional businesses are providing a crucial buffer against the intense volatility of the fuel segment. It validates their diversified approach.
Precisely. It fundamentally demonstrates the strength of their diversified approach to absorbing shocks from the more volatile parts of their business.
Mm-hmm.
Even amidst these financial headwinds and the significant guidance revision, Darling has not been idle. They've been making strategic moves to position themselves for future growth and unlock value.
Yes, I recall you mentioning something about a new joint venture, Nextida, and some financial maneuvering.
That's right. In May 2025, they announced a non-binding term sheet to combine their collagen and gelatin businesses with those of Tessenderlo Group to form a new entity called Nextida.
Combining with another company's assets.
Yes. This is a significant strategic move designed to unlock substantial value and create a focused, pure-play leader in the rapidly growing health and wellness market, separate from the broader, more volatile Darling entity. They also successfully refinanced a significant portion of their long-term debt in Q2 2025, which improved their financial flexibility and locked in borrowing costs for the future, a very smart and proactive move during a challenging period of rising interest rates.
Good timing on the refinancing, likely. So, despite these recent challenges and the undeniable volatility in the renewable fuels market, Darling Ingredients is clearly looking forward. What does their path forward look like in terms of growth strategies and future opportunities? It seems like they're remarkably well positioned to leverage some major secular tailwinds regardless of short-term policy shifts.
They absolutely are. Their entire business model is intrinsically aligned with profound, long-term, global megatrends. The push toward a fully circular economy, the imperative of decarbonization across various sectors, and the ongoing powerful trend of premiumization in both human food and pet food.
Those are big, durable trends.
They are. These are not fleeting fads. These are powerful, multi-decade drivers that Darling is structurally positioned to benefit from.
Let's circle back to the renewable energy expansion, particularly the future of fuel. Even with the recent turbulence, it sounds like sustainable aviation fuel, or SAF, is a massive part of their future vision for Diamond Green Diesel.
It is a critical future growth vector, potentially even more stable and incentivized than renewable diesel in the long run. Diamond Green Diesel is already one of the world's largest producers of SAF, which is crucial for decarbonizing the aviation sector, a notoriously difficult industry to clean up due to the high energy density requirements of jet fuel.
Yeah, batteries aren't going to work for long-haul flights anytime soon.
Exactly. The market for SAF is projected to grow exponentially, driven by strong policy incentives and global airline commitments. For example, the U.S. Inflation Reduction Act, the IRA, provides significant tax credits specifically for SAF production, making it economically attractive.
So the policy support for SAF might be stronger or clearer than for renewable diesel?
Potentially, yes. And in Europe, the RE2 mandates are creating structural demand for SAF as airlines and fuel suppliers face escalating blending obligations. Management has consistently expressed unwavering confidence in the long-term value and growth of DGD, especially as these supportive policies fully take effect and demand outstrips current supply.
And what about renewable diesel itself? Given the current challenges, how do they view its recovery or continued role?
While the renewable diesel market is certainly facing headwinds right now, primarily due to the policy uncertainty we discussed, it remains a core component of their strategy. Darling anticipates that clearer, more stable policy signals in the U.S., especially regarding the renewable fuel standard's future, will eventually lead to a more stable and profitable margin environment.
So they expect policy to eventually stabilize.
That seems to be the bet. DGD's large-scale, highly efficient production facilities are remarkably well-positioned to capitalize on that recovery once policy clarity emerges and the market normalizes. It's about enduring the short-term volatility for the significant long-term opportunity, essentially waiting for the market to catch up to the policy ambitions.
Beyond fuel, how are they planning to grow and strengthen their other segments through product portfolio diversification and innovation? You mentioned the Nextida joint venture as a major step.
That Nextida joint venture is indeed a pivotal strategic initiative. By creating a pure-play leader in the collagen and gelatin space, in partnership with Tessenderlo Group, they're aiming to accelerate growth in the rapidly expanding health and wellness market.
Spin it off, sort of, to let it shine.
Basically, This is a sophisticated strategic move designed to achieve two things. First, to accelerate operational growth by giving this high-potential business line dedicated focus and resources. And second, to act as a form of financial engineering. They believe this venture has the potential to potentially double the earnings of that specific business line within 3 to 5 years by unlocking value that might not be fully recognized or appropriately valued when subsumed within their broader, more volatile consolidated structure.
So grow faster and get a better valuation multiple for it.
That's the goal. It's about giving that higher margin segment its own spotlight, in a way, to truly maximize its value. And beyond that, they are continually exploring new end market developments for their bio-based ingredients. They're looking for new, innovative applications in areas like cosmetics, where there's growing demand for natural and sustainable ingredients, in pharmaceuticals, for specialized excipients and active ingredients, and in other industrial uses, such as bio-based plastics, lubricants, and even certain advanced nutraceuticals.
Always looking for the next thing.
This continuous exploration further diversifies their revenue streams away from traditional feed and fuel markets, spreading risk and opening up new growth avenues.
And finally, what role do acquisitions play in their future growth strategy? Is inorganic growth still a core tenet for them?
Absolutely. Inorganic growth through strategic acquisitions has been and will continue to be a core tenet of Darling's growth strategy. The global rendering industry, despite Darling's dominant position, is still relatively fragmented, presenting ample opportunities for Darling to continue acting as a consolidator.
Still room to buy more companies.
Definitely. Their acquisition pipeline is meticulously focused on expanding their geographic footprint, especially in underpenetrated or emerging markets, enhancing their raw material sourcing capabilities, and gaining access to new technologies or specialized processing capabilities that complement their existing operations. They maintain a disciplined approach to M&A, ensuring that future acquisitions are not only strategic, but also accretive to shareholder value, strengthening their competitive moats and driving further economies of scale.
So it's a very deliberate combination of organic growth in high-potential areas like SAF and specialty food ingredients, strategic partnerships like Nextida to unlock value, and continued disciplined consolidation of a fragmented industry. It paints a picture of a company with a clear vision, navigating complex markets.
I think that sums it up well. They're playing multiple angles.
Now, for the big question for anyone interested in this company, how do we decode the value of Darling Ingredients? Valuing a company with such a unique mix of mature, stable businesses and a highly volatile, high-growth sector must be incredibly complex for analysts and investors.
It absolutely is, and this dichotomy makes traditional valuation metrics a bit distorted, especially given their recent earnings declines driven primarily by the fuel segment's challenges.
Right, the earnings part of PE is weighed down right now.
Exactly. For instance, if you look at their trailing price-to-earnings, or PE ratio, it's currently around 47 times earnings.
Mm-hmm.
That's significantly elevated compared to their historical average of about 25 times over the last decade.
Wow, 47 times earnings sounds very, very high for a company with such a significant traditional business.
It is, and that's largely because the denominator, their current earnings per share, is at a cyclical low due to that DGD downturn. The market sees that as a temporary blip.
Okay, so the market is looking past the current dip.
It seems so. However, if you look at their forward PE ratio, which is based on analyst estimates for future earnings, it's dramatically lower, around 9.6 times.
9.6 times 4. That's a huge difference from 47 trailing.
It is. This wide gap tells you that the market is clearly anticipating a very substantial recovery in earnings, almost entirely driven by an expected rebound in the DGD joint venture's profitability. It's a forward-looking bet on policy clarity and improved crush spreads.
So the market is pricing in a significant rebound in that volatile segment. What about a less distorted metric, like enterprise value to EBITDA? Does that help?
Maybe a bit. The trailing 12-month EV/EBITDA multiple is approximately 11.15 times. This metric is often preferred for companies with significant debt or disparate assets, as it's less affected by non-cash charges like depreciation and amortization, and gives a clearer picture of their valuation based on operating cash flow before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization.
And how does that 11.15x compare?
Well, when you try to compare Darling to direct peers, it's exceptionally tough because, as we discussed, there isn't a single company that does everything Darling does. But if you look at agricultural and food processing peers like Tyson or ADM, their trailing PE ratios are typically in the mid-20s, and Bunge's even lower, around 8.2x. Darling's trailing PE is notably higher, reflecting that premium the market assigns to its renewable fuels exposure and the current temporary trough in its earnings.
So it's getting valued more like a growth renewable play than a traditional ag processor, despite the earnings dip.
That's a fair assessment. It's priced as a growth company with a temporary earnings dip, not a staid agricultural processor.
So if you can't find a direct peer, how do analysts typically approach valuing a company like this with such distinct segments? I've heard of something called sum of the parts, or SOTP, valuation.
That's precisely the framework to use, and it's quite powerful for understanding Darling's true underlying value. A sum of the parts analysis is invaluable for companies with disparate segments, where each segment has its own distinct growth prospects, risk profile, and therefore its own appropriate valuation multiple.
Break it down and value each piece separately.
Exactly. You basically value each part of the company separately using relevant industry multiples, and then add them up to arrive at a total enterprise value.
Can you walk us through how that might hypothetically work for Darling, giving us a clearer sense of how each piece might be valued?
Certainly. For the feed ingredients segment, which is characterized by stable, mature cash flows, you might apply an EV/EBITDA multiple, similar to other well-established agricultural processors or even waste management companies, perhaps in the range of 7x to 9x. It's a consistent but lower growth business.
Okay, 7 to 9 times EBITDA for feed. Makes sense.
For the food ingredients segment, which is higher growth, generates higher margins, and includes innovative products like collagen peptides, especially with the potential of the Nextida joint venture, you could justify a significantly higher multiple. We're talking perhaps 12x to 15x EV/EBITDA, similar to specialty food ingredient companies or health and wellness firms that command a premium for their intellectual property and market position.
Much higher multiple for food, maybe 12 to 15x.
Got it. And then the fuel ingredient segment, the volatile one, that must be the trickiest piece of the puzzle, the one that really swings the total valuation.
Yeah. How do you put a multiple on that uncertainty?
It is by far the most challenging and often the most debated component to value. Its multiple is highly sensitive to critical assumptions about the long-term profitability of renewable diesel and SAF, and most crucially, the future stability and trajectory of the policy environment.
So it depends heavily on your policy outlook.
Massively. In a very bearish, policy uncertain scenario, it might only command a low single-digit multiple. But in a bullish scenario, where policy support is clear, sustained, and highly incentivizing, it could justify a high teens or even 20x plus multiple.
Wow, that's a huge range. Low single digits to maybe 20 times.
It is. The profound implication here is that a very significant portion of Darling's current enterprise value is currently tied to the future earnings potential of that fuel segment. Its valuation is a direct reflection of investor confidence, or lack thereof, in the stability and long-term support for renewable fuels policies.
That reliance on the fuel segment's future potential also vividly highlights the risks, doesn't it? What are the key risk factors and sensitivities you'd highlight for a potential investor or simply someone trying to understand this company?
Absolutely. The biggest risk, hands down, and the one that has manifested most recently, is regulatory and policy uncertainty.
We keep coming back to that.
Because it's paramount. The profitability of Diamond Green Diesel is fundamentally dependent on government mandates like the U.S. Renewable Fuel Standard and California's Low Carbon Fuel Standard. Any adverse changes or reduction in blending mandates, changes in credit calculation methodologies, or, critically, an increase in small refinery exemptions like the SREs that caused so much pressure in Q2 2025 could severely impact their profitability. That 84% decline in Q2 2025 net income was a direct, recent, and painful manifestation of this policy risk.
A real-world example of the risk hitting home.
It's a literal pen stroke in Washington or Sacramento that can send their biggest growth engine into reverse.
What else keeps management up at night?
Another significant risk is raw material and commodity price volatility. The availability and cost of animal byproducts and used cooking oil can fluctuate wildly due to various factors. Things like major animal diseases, such as African swine fever or avian influenza outbreaks, can disrupt the supply of animal byproducts from the meat processing industry, directly impacting their feedstock costs.
Supply shocks on the input side.
Right. Increased competition for these feedstocks, especially from other renewable fuel producers, can also drive up input costs.
And the energy markets themselves, beyond just the credits.
Yes. Energy market and environmental credit dynamics are crucial. While higher crude oil and petroleum diesel prices generally support higher renewable diesel prices, the value of RINs and LCFS credits is the more significant and volatile component, as we've discussed. These credit markets are driven by complex regulatory mandates and compliance deadlines, and their prices can swing dramatically, often independent of underlying fuel prices, creating extreme volatility in DGD's margins.
So even if oil prices are stable, the credit prices can swing wildly.
Precisely. Then there's robust competition across all segments, including large, well-capitalized meat processors and rendering, and major oil companies in biofuels.
Can't forget the competition.
And finally, broader market and economic risks are always present. Changing dietary trends, like a long-term societal shift towards plant-based alternatives, could reduce their core raw material supply. A global recession could impact overall fuel demand or even dampen sales in their premium pet food segment.
And being global adds currency risk too, right?
Yes. Lastly, as a truly global company, they have significant currency exposure. A strengthening U.S. dollar, for example, can lead to lower reported revenues and profits from their international operations when translated back into dollars.
Okay, a lot to consider on the risk side. Given all these risks and the compelling growth opportunities, how is Darling allocating its capital? What are their priorities when it comes to investing in the business versus, say, returning capital to shareholders?
Their capital allocation strategy is quite clear and disciplined, reflecting their long-term growth ambitions and commitment to financial stability. They prioritize in this order. First, investing in high-return organic growth projects within their existing operations, like expanding SAF production or specialty ingredient capabilities. Second, pursuing strategic and accretive acquisitions to consolidate the industry and expand their footprint and capabilities. Third, maintaining a strong balance sheet.
Keeping debt in check.
Right. They reported $3.98 billion in total debt in Q2 2025. But importantly, their bank covenant leverage ratio actually improved to 3.34x by the end of Q2 2025, demonstrating active debt management and financial prudence. And finally, fourth, opportunistically returning capital to shareholders via share buybacks. Though it's important to note that Darling currently does not pay a regular dividend.
No dividend, but buyback. So growth and balance sheet strength are top priorities.
Definitely at the top of their list.
So we've taken a truly exhaustive deep dive into Darling Ingredients, a remarkable company uniquely positioned right at the intersection of waste, food, and fuel. We've seen how their stable feed and food segments provide a crucial, consistent foundation acting as a financial ballast.
Yeah, the anchor.
Meanwhile, their volatile but high-growth fuel segment drives much of their future potential, navigating incredibly complex and policy-driven landscapes that can make or break profitability.
What stands out here is that profound core dichotomy. The consistent cash-generating rendering business acting as the anchor and providing resilience versus the dynamic policy-driven world of renewable energy that represents the high beta growth engine.
High beta is a good way to put it.
This fascinating blend presents both significant inherent stability in their core and substantial sensitivity to external factors, particularly those unpredictable regulatory shifts. It's a company built on the mundane, but transformed by innovation and global imperatives.
So what does this all mean for you, our listener? Whether you're thinking about the intricate workings of global supply chains, the critical future of sustainable energy, or even just the precise ingredients that go into your pet's premium food, Darling Ingredients shows us the immense, often overlooked, value that can be extracted from what we once simply considered waste. It challenges our very definition of what is valuable.
It really does. Consider this provocative thought. As the world pushes further towards a truly circular economy and the imperative of decarbonization intensifies across industries, will companies like Darling Ingredients, with their deep logistical moats, specialized waste-to-value expertise, and critical role in both food and fuel, become even more indispensable infrastructure for our future, despite the inherent market volatilities they inevitably face?
Will they become even more essential?
And how will the evolving interplay of shifting consumer demand for sustainable products, rapid technological innovation in bioprocessing, and the often unpredictable hand of government policy continue to reshape the value and role of what we once so casually dismissed as waste?
Powerful questions for our future, indeed. What stood out to YU in this deep dive? We encourage you to keep exploring, keep asking questions, and keep digging deeper into the fascinating and often surprising world around us. Until next time, stay curious.